This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. A long journey for the feminist vision of equality in the United States swells to a grand flourish tonight in Philadelphia, a narrative that dominated the 20th century and is just as powerful in the 21st. In electoral politics, this convention, nominating Hillary Clinton to be president, contains the echo of this moment 40 years ago.
United States, Jimmy Carter.
A feminist activist and at one time the most powerful woman in American politics, Midge Costanza got close to the reins of power reserved for men in Washington, D.C. She was an influential advisor on women's issues to President Jimmy Carter, a look back at the long feminist road that has led to this convention in Philadelphia. But this week's nomination of the first female presidential candidate of a major party in American history has been a long time coming for Secretary Clinton herself. And so many fellow successful politicians are in Philadelphia convinced that this is a historic moment, even more historic than the strange, unpredictable Republican convention of a week ago. Senator Debbie Stabenow of Michigan has endorsed Hillary Clinton for the 2016 election. She did it over 2 years ago, back in May of 2014. Stabenow is the senior senator from Michigan in office since 2001. She joins us now. Welcome to The Takeaway, Senator.
Well, it's great to be with you, John. It's exciting times.
What do you think is the meaning of this election race and the Hillary Clinton candidacy, as you can tell?
It's really a moment for us to decide, I think, who we are as a country. And having worked with Hillary for over 30 years on issues ranging from protecting children and families and family violence to serving with her in the Senate, I mean, this is somebody who really gets what we need to do to make sure everybody is successful in this country and not just a few folks at the top.
This latest email scandal doesn't appear to be made up because Debbie Wasserman Schultz is stepping aside. They appear to be connected. What do you make of all that?
You know, it was wrong. Those emails were just plain wrong. Debbie's done a lot of important work, I think, worked hard for the party, but I think she's doing the right thing stepping down. We need unity. You know, we're also seeing now this whole other piece of what, you know, what is very disturbing to me about the emails. In fact, if this was Russian hackers and what does that mean? And, you know, all the relationship, the things that Donald Trump has said, praising Putin and attacking our allies and questioning whether he would protect our NATO allies from Russia. There's a whole disturbing undercurrent, I think, that we're going to have to really take another look at.
But doesn't this email scandal suggest that there is a kind of Hillary Clinton machine that will, by any means necessary, get her elected, and that it's more about electing her than it is a bigger vision? And that's what the Bernie Sanders people are so outraged about, and the way in which he was treated in these emails?
Well, first of all, the DNC is hundreds of people, and so they're people of different backgrounds. I know people in the DNC supporting Bernie, people supporting Hillary. I don't think those emails had any impact in terms of what happened in the election. Bernie ran a great race, bringing in people into the party and speaking out for things that we all care deeply about. And he's had a profound impact on the platform. Ultimately, when it became clear about these emails, he was successful in making the case that she should step down, and she has. And so I think to say people haven't listened to him or his supporters really isn't true. In fact, they've been successful.
Finally, Senator Stabenow, the election of Barack Obama in 2008, which was a defeat for Hillary Clinton in the primaries, came with a very deep emotional narrative of the first African-American president. And despite all the personality issues and the contentious rhetoric in that campaign, that stayed straight through to November in the election and was really part of what propelled Barack Obama into the White House. Are you worried that the same emotional narrative of feminists being committed to female leadership in the United States, that gets lost in the way this campaign is so far being conducted? What does it mean for you as a feminist?
Well, I'm really excited about this. I mean, having been involved myself through the years, having to work hard to open doors, not just for myself, but for other women and for my daughter and now my granddaughter, and to see the opportunity this week. And I think you're going to see a whole level of focus and excitement on the fact that we, again, are making history. And we have, for me, what's most exciting, not only the most qualified person to be president of the United States, but that it's a woman.
Senator Debbie Stabenow, senior U.S. Senator from Michigan, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Todd Zwillick, takeaway Washington correspondent, is on the streets of Philly where it's being described as a furnace.
The Convention Hall, Philadelphia, July 15th, 1948. Inside, a three-ring circus called the Democratic Convention. The city is a furnace.
That was 1948, and delegates and reporters had only their imaginations to tell them the temperature. Now the three-digit Fahrenheit blues is right there on everybody's smartphone. The Democrats have some divisions to mend, just as Republicans did this time last week. Michelle Obama will be speaking tonight, along with Clinton's former rival, Bernie Sanders, who has a lot of very angry supporters ready to walk through fire for him. Todd Zwillick has already seen them walking through the fiery, summer-scalded streets of the city of brotherly love.
John, those pro-Bernie protesters were out on the streets yesterday, 95 degrees or more, a big crowd of Bernie supporters gathered in the middle of the city. They marched all the way down to FDR Park, which is adjacent to the police cordon at the convention venue. Mike Michelson is one of them. He's from Erie, Pennsylvania.
I have an old school bus that I use as an RV, and it says Bernie or Bust on it, the Bernie or Bust bus.
John, Mike builds locomotives for General Electric in Erie. He's a union man, and he counts himself firmly, never Hillary.
Never. I her husband ruined my job, my life. When he voted for NAFTA, I lost my job for 2 years. TPP was the gold standard. Then it wasn't bad. Now she's back on it. It's disgusting. I can't trust her. I would never vote for her.
He sounds pretty emotional, Todd. Does he reflect any constituency within the hall there in Philly?
John, there's no doubt that he does, and here's the point. It's impossible to know how big that constituency is, and more importantly, how big that constituency is out in the country when people vote in November. John, the leaked emails are at the front of everyone's mind this week, of course, and they promise to weigh heavily on the convention all this week. They show DNC officials very dismissive, in some cases against Bernie's candidacy, and talking about how to undermine it in some cases, including with a strategy to question whether Bernie Sanders is really Jewish or actually an atheist. So far, there's no evidence that the email conversations were ever put into practice in the primary. But for this crowd, it confirms a narrative. The primary was rigged and Hillary stole it. Dave Pillmeyer was a protester, and John, he was looking at his phone during the march and broke the news to some people around him.
Schultz resigned. Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
You just heard that?
Yeah, I just heard it. I'm back there. Debbie Wasserman Schultz resigned. I just heard it. That's awesome. Maybe that's the start for ending corruption.
Mr. Pillmeyer there, of course, announcing what will now be the resignation of Debbie Wasserman Schultz after this convention. Does she take the rap for these emails completely, or is this something that goes higher than Debbie Wasserman Schultz?
Well, there is no way for it to go higher than Debbie Wasserman Schultz unless these voters decide that as a result of this, they'll never vote for Hillary, right? She's the one who's trying to be president. That's the only way it goes higher. A lot of people, I don't know how many in this crowd, they're like Mike Michelson, right? Never, ever Hillary. But John, everyone in the crowd is also aware, and many of them don't like the question. Bernie Sanders himself has endorsed Hillary. And as angry as they are, Sanders himself said on Sunday, repeating that despite the emails, he's still backing Hillary. I talked to Lewis Rawlinson. He drove all the way to Philly from Chicago.
I am admittedly not Bernie or Bust. I would be open to the idea of voting for Clinton if she really is clear about what she's going to support, sticks to the platform, which I think is a really positive thing. I would be open to voting for her, but I would also be open to voting for Jill Stein. So I would need to have a long, hard think and explore my options.
it's a choice between Hillary and Jill Stein. That's pretty interesting, but that's got to be a tiny minority.
Well, a lot of people said Jill Stein, but I think the point about Lewis Rawlinson here is that he's gettable, right? Hillary could convince him. In this particular crowd, I found relatively few Lewis's, people who said they were gettable. Most people in this crowd, the protesters, are holding out hope that some kind of floor fight will convince the superdelegates that the whole nomination needs to be reversed and flip them to Bernie's side. Now, that's unlikely, of course, and many of them say, if not, they will in fact vote Green Party and Jill Stein. But behind it all, John, is the bottom line that no one likes, the one that Bernie Sanders has drawn himself. Hillary Clinton is the only candidate who can realistically stop Donald Trump from winning the White House. So accept the concessions that Bernie Sanders has extracted from Hillary on minimum wage and student debt and other issues, and get behind her. John, I found Laura Slitt in the 30th Street train station. She'd just gotten off the platform from her home in New Hampshire, and she had just heard the news that Debbie Wasserman Schultz has been sidelined.
It's tokenism. If she's being a scapegoat for the deeper, more insidious machine that's operating, it's something, but it's tokenism and it's not nearly enough.
John, Laura at first in our conversation described herself as never voting for Hillary, no matter what. But then the more we talked, the more you heard the dilemma creep through.
They couldn't. I'm not going to hold my nose and say I'm going to vote. I don't. That's the big question mark that people who are unwavering supporters of Bernie Sanders are going to have to be faced with. Right now, the ground has fallen away from our feet, and we're not really sure what's going to happen. And because we trust him so much, we're waiting to get our cues from him and only him. I'm going to see what happens over the next couple of days, and then I'm going to try to figure out how to proceed.
Well, Todd, this race really is the difference between which parties stay-at-home voters is bigger. Will the Republicans force more people to stay at home than the Democrats? It seems to me that the Democrats don't have anything like the identity crisis that the Republicans did a week ago today.
Yeah, there's no doubt that it's smaller. Their identity crisis is smaller. They are more unified than the Republicans last week, but not completely unified, John. There's talk of a possible walkout of Bernie delegates during the voting this week on the convention floor. And look, nobody knows exactly how many Laura's or Mike Michelson's, the never Hillary guy from Erie, Pennsylvania, there are out there a world away from Philadelphia. And these diehard supporters and many others around the country and in the Clinton campaign are going to be watching carefully, John.
Todd Zwillig, takeaway Washington correspondent in Philadelphia all week for the Democratic National Convention. Will it be raining purple this fall on the electoral map of the USA? Changing demographics in this country have Democrats suddenly seeing purple where they once saw only red, like the state of Virginia, the state where Tim Kaine, Hillary Clinton's running mate, is a senator. Terry McAuliffe is governor of Virginia. McAuliffe once held the post of chairman of the Democratic National Committee, the same one that Debbie Wasserman Schultz is vacating under a storm of controversy. McAuliffe and I had a chance to talk some pre-convention politics at the National Governors Conference in Iowa earlier this month. McAuliffe has a long history with the Clintons. He co-ran Bill Clinton's 1996 re-election campaign and Hillary Clinton's unsuccessful 2008 campaign. McAuliffe says, once old South Virginia represents the new America that the GOP, he says, is actively paddling away from.
It's a different state today. You know, I was very proud the other day. I announced a 3.8% unemployment. It was 5.4 when I became governor, so it's a 32-year drop, steepest decline in 32 years. It's a strong economy. We have challenges, probably more than any state in America, because of sequestration. We have the most military. You know, we have the Pentagon, the CIA, Quantico. We have the largest naval base in the world. All of that, when we get hit by sequestration, as we did a couple years ago, about $10 billion we lost direct spending. And as you know, Congress has pushed it off. We're about a year, year and a half from the next round. Let's hopefully we can work it out. But you've got to remember that no Democrat had won Virginia since 1964, since Lyndon Johnson. President Obama, as you know, won in 2008, and he won again in 2012. I think Virginia today is a purple trending blue in presidential years. I would still make the argument that it, and remember, we have elections every year. The governor's up next year, deliberately. I think it's a purple trending red in the off years because a lot of folks, the federal voters, whatever, don't come out and vote. It's more challenging. When I won the governorship 2 years ago, I broke a 44-year trend whoever wins the White House, the other party wins the governor's mansion. I brought my lieutenant governor, attorney general, first time in 24 years, Democrats swept. First time in 40 years, Democrats control all five statewides. So what's happened, I think the Northern Virginia quarter, I believe now that a majority of people who live in Virginia were not born in Virginia. So it is a different state than it was in 1992 when President Clinton ran for office. It is a purple-blue state in a presidential year because of turnout. And the growth of our Hispanic population. And Donald Trump and his wall and all of his insults that he's hurled, he has really hurt the ability of the Republican Party to put together an Electoral College victory.
Iranians who were involved in the student uprising in the beginning, who eventually got into the government and, you know, have since left, and having covered Iran over a very long period of time in my career. At a certain point, one of the analyses of what happened in 1980 was that the hostage crisis was something that the Iranian government was sick of. They really didn't know what to do with it. It was a monster. But they saw an opportunity to determine the 1980 presidential race by holding on to those hostages. And they didn't much care. They hated Carter, of course, and Reagan was viewed as a kind of a strange outlier by some in the United States. And by this analysis, some Iranians felt very proud that they were able to determine the outcome of the 1980 election. By that same token, ISIS may be considering the same kind of tactic. If some wild card were to be pulled out of the terrorism deck between now and November, what would you advise a candidate to do to project to America what needs to be projected so that Americans don't vote with their gut and brainstem?
And I think it's different than we went through that in 1980. I mean, we had American hostages there for, 400 days? And I think that what hurt President Carter, remember, they played us like a fiddle. They were going to release them, not release them. And then, like, the weekend before on Friday, they were letting them out, and then they didn't. I think the American public just was exasperated. They talk about the polling on Friday going into it. Mr. Cadell, who was the president's pollster, had it about even, but after that last Iranian, the floor fell out. It's different today, John, I would say, because we now have gone through, very unfortunately, so many instances. You know, we're fresh in our mind of what's happened here in America. We've had like five incidences in the last couple of years. You know, it's now here in America. It's not to the extent that we now see it, what happened in Brussels and obviously what happened in Nice. And we do everything we can to prepare ourselves. But if there is some type of international incident, I would argue that it would inure to Hillary's benefit because of her experience, her strength. She, as Secretary of State, people know that she is a calm hand on the levers of power that have to deal with these issues. You know as well as I do, and I'm sure you talk to the military. I talk to the military constantly because I have such a presence in Virginia. They're worried to death about Donald Trump. You know, you can't run a military or defense operation with knee-jerk comments, and they're very concerned about how we commit our troops in the future. It's nice to have this big talk about make America great and we're going to do this, you're talking about men and women's lives. And every parent, like I do, Dorothy and I have a son in the uniform, you know, you're very concerned about reckless talk and Cal's disregard for what should be military engagement rules. And I would just argue, if something came out that really scared people, they literally are going to pivot to who they think will be a steady hand in a time of crisis.
Hillary Clinton supporter and governor of Virginia, Terry McAuliffe, speaking at the National Governors Conference earlier this month. Global no-no. Republicans told us all last week that U.S. economic woes are due to bad trade deals.
America has lost nearly one-third of its manufacturing jobs since 1997, following the enactment of disastrous trade deals supported by Bill and Hillary Clinton.
Donald Trump cries woe and gloom, while economic analysts around the world believe that, in fact, the U.S. economy is the bright spot in the world right now. The referendum on the safety of U.S. assets is a landslide in favor of the U.S., at least for now. Investments are pouring into the U.S., even if U.S. voters don't see it that way. What workers see in their economies and what governments see is the principal gauge of future prosperity, according to our next guest. Can workers make a living wage? How companies compete? If government and workers understand these to be priorities, then a bright future is possible. When workers and governments are completely at odds, as in Brazil, Turkey, and South Africa, rising stars can falter. Ruchir Sharma is head of emerging markets and chief global strategist at Morgan Stanley Investment Management and the author of The Rise and Fall of Nations, Forces of Change in the Post-Crisis World. Since the 2008 crash, he says, politics has become a wedge in the global economic system.
The longer a leader stays in office, the worse it is for a nation. And this is particularly true in developing countries where the institutions tend to be weak. So the leaders can have a big impact on that country. And this is my entire point in that chapter about Putin, about Erdogan. These are leaders that I have met and spent some time with. And it's the classic case that when they first came to office, they were very different. But by year 7, 8, and especially after a decade, they turn into very different creatures. And I think that's what's happened with Erdogan as well. When he first came to office, he was good for Turkey. He was carrying out a lot of economic reforms. And he has really slipped very badly now. And I think that currently I despair for what's happening in Turkey.
In reading this book, I looked back at the Brexit story and I thought to myself, you know, maybe this is all just smoke and mirrors. And that essentially what you describe in this book is that these relationships between Europe and Britain are unassailable. The underpinning relationship between Britain and the rest of Europe must go on.
Yeah, I think so, because I think that there's far too much for Britain to lose. But I think there's a bigger point about Brexit. Brexit is more effect than cause. And what do I mean by that? Every single thing we believed in about the world last decade has been turned on its head. And one of the very big trends, and I think Brexit is a manifestation of that, is that there's a massive anti-establishment wave running through the world today. So we track the popularity ratings of the leaders in the world's 20 largest democracies. They're down 20 percentage points. The fundamental cause here is that this is the weakest economic recovery in post-war history. And I think that that's what's really causing so much angst among voters across the world.
You describe a well-behaved billionaire in your attempt to chart success of an economy by looking at the success of individuals and leaders, corporate leaders, et cetera, in that country. What's a well-behaved billionaire?
Good billionaires are the ones which are respected by a country. If you create wealth in industries such as technology, manufacturing, pharmaceuticals, or stuff where the consumer at large feels that he or she is benefiting from this, those billionaires are well respected. On the other hand, when you have wealth creation taking place by billionaires who are doing it through government connections, by gaming the system in industries which are prone to it, such as real estate, mining, or even oil and gas very often in large parts of the world, you end up getting a very negative reaction. And this is a point I make in the book, that if you look at the United States today, one redeeming quality I still find here is that no matter what we think of Trump, the fact that someone like Trump is being able to make a run for the top office despite being a billionaire, I think still tells you that wealth creation in this country is still sort of respected and not held against you. I travel to other countries, and from Russia to Mexico, there are so many bad billionaires or perceived to be bad that there's no way that they'd be able to make a run for the top office because the people just wouldn't stand for it.
What do you make of the economic discussion that's taking place in the U.S. election? America will be great again. We'll get these jobs back again. We'll change all these trade agreements. Is it talking nonsense? Does it have any basis in reality? Is the conversation, whether it's right or wrong, looking at a world the same way you see it?
Unfortunately not, because I think that what's really happened here is that a strength taken too far has become a weakness. So we had unfettered globalization for the last 3 decades. Obviously, not everyone benefited from it. So we seem to be stuck in this situation, which is that a backlash is taking place and the policy responses that we are taking towards those, which is to turn more inward, to sort of give up on free trade agreements, to close our borders much more to immigration. These are all likely to only worsen the situation.
Why does Brazil seem to be such a basket case in so many ways? It's politically unstable right now. It has enormous natural resources that have not been utilized well. Its agricultural sector is in trouble. Why can't Brazil do better?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, because Brazil today is as poor compared to the United States as it was 100 years ago. That's a damning statement that, you know, because standard economic theory says that poor countries should over time close the gap with richer nations. And in Brazil, it's not happened. Now, there are two reasons. Typically, commodity exporting countries do much worse than countries which rely on manufacturing. But there's one really big fundamental problem in Brazil, which is that they prematurely created too large a welfare state. There is no other mainstream emerging market which spends as much on subsidies and welfare as Brazil spends. And that's what chokes off investment elsewhere. And that's why Brazil's taxes are so high and punitive that it's very hard to do business in that country.
Who scares you the most in terms of economic instability on a scale that could produce what we had in the crisis in 2008? Another example of that.
By far, China. This is a nation that I was in awe of growing up because of the incredible economic miracle that they produced for 30 years. But they really lost the plot after the global financial crisis in 2008-2009. They were keen to grow very rapidly in a much slower growth world, and they threw so much money and so much debt at the problem that since then they've not been able to sort of get back to normal. So if you look at the world today, this is really a G2 world, which is it's like about America and it's about China. These are the only two economies which can have global repercussions because of their size. And as far as China is concerned, the fact that it's become so addicted to debt that every time now they have even a minor economic slowdown, they just want to keep throwing more debt at the problem to somehow keep growth going is what scares me the most. Because when a nation takes on too much debt over a short span of time, I demonstrate that nation always runs into trouble in the next 5 years. And China, I think, is at that sort of point now.
Rishir Sharma is head of emerging markets and chief global strategist at Morgan Stanley Investment Management. He's the author of The Rise and Fall of Nations, Forces of Change in the Post-Crisis World. Thanks so much.
Enjoyed being here. Thanks, Jill.
I felt that the White House belonged to everybody and they had a right to petition their government. Women all over this world are experiencing success today in a different way than they ever have.
Once upon a time, a small-town politician from Rochester, New York, named Midge Costanza, believed in the cause of equality for men and women and wasn't afraid to say it to anyone.
I stand before you, someone who some of you may totally agree with, some of you may partially agree with, and some of you will try to aim at my bulletproof bra before I do.
Margaret Midge Costanza used that bulletproof bra line wherever she campaigned. She was a feminist, an activist, and someone who believed that Jimmy Carter would give feminism a higher public profile than ever before. In 1976, she showed her success to the world on the podium at the Democratic National Convention in New York City.
I am proud to second the nomination of a man I dearly love as a decent human being, the next president of the United States, Jimmy Carter.
Under President Jimmy Carter, Midge Costanza was named first woman assistant for public liaison to a U.S. president. Costanza didn't have a college education, but she used her position to push for women's rights, a more open administration, but was unsuccessful on gay and lesbian rights in the 1976 Democratic Party platform. As a White House insider, she enthralled the press, but tension between her and Carter's white male inner circle led to her early resignation. Doreen Mattingly is an associate professor of women's studies at San Diego State University and author of A Feminist in the White House, Midge Costanza, The Carter Years and America's Culture Wars. She says Costanza, who died in 2010, never lost her feisty spirit.
She was a one of a kind. She was an activist within the political system. She believed in democracy. She believed in participatory democracy, specifically that people could use the political system to make change. And that's what she tried to do as city councilwoman in Rochester, New York, and as assistant to President Carter. But she was also a street smart, working class, funny, irreverent broad, you might say, who had a style that surprised a lot of people in Washington.
How did she rise so high to have the ear of President Carter for as long as she did?
Carter came to Rochester, New York, where she was running for Congress in 1974, and the two just became fast friends. He trusted her. He didn't have too many friends in New York, so he asked her to run his New York State presidential campaign. She was an idealist, but she differed from Carter on a number of issues. She was a Roosevelt Democrat. She wanted a large government, and he wanted a small one. She thought that an open administration meant bringing everybody in to state their opinion, and he meant that an open administration was transparent and not subject to political maneuvering. They differed on how he should keep his promises to America. She felt like he needed to do more for disenfranchised groups. And he felt for women, for example, he had done enough by appointing women to high office like her.
How was her chemistry with other prominent feminists of the time, Gloria Steinem, Bella Abzug?
Bella was a dear friend for her whole life until Bella passed, and her mentor in many ways. And she turned to Bella and Gloria both for advice when she was in the White House and listened to them a lot about how to proceed on women's issues.
Did she think that the Watergate moment was a transformative moment and that she was living at the exact perfect time to accomplish what she wanted to accomplish?
Watergate confirmed her beliefs about the need for participatory democracy and an open administration. And so Watergate certainly legitimated her approach in her mind to what she was doing in the White House, bringing in the perspectives of marginalized groups of gays and lesbians, of Native Americans, of women, and trying to use the White House to advocate them. And so whether she believed it created the perfect opportunity, it did create an opportunity that she tried to exploit to the best of her ability to forward the issues she believed in.
Did she misread the political winds of the time in terms of what her power actually was versus what she thought it could be?
I think in some ways she was surprised she lasted as long as she did. And I think that she read accurately the political whims of the time about the rise of the right. She was the voice in the White House who was always telling Carter he could not straddle social issues that were becoming more and more partisan. He couldn't straddle the abortion issue. He couldn't try to play both sides on gay rights. He could not craft a middle road. He needed to go to the left.
What do you know of the moment when Midge Costanza really understood that she had to part company with Jimmy Carter on some level?
She had been asked to tell David Hartman, the host of Good Morning America, that she would have a headache and wouldn't be on the show the next day. There was a scandal that broke about drugs in the White House, and they didn't want her on national TV. And she said, no, I'm not going to lie for you. This is how Watergate started. People lied. And when she got called into the president's office, he asked her why she didn't lie. And she said that was the moment when she knew that she no longer had any protection in the White House and that she had to go. And she wrote, if you could hear a heartbreak, that's what you would have heard in that room.
What was her belief in the Equal Rights Amendment, and what did she expect would happen, and how did she respond when the ERA went into the dustbin of 70s and 80s history?
Like many supporters of the ERA at that time, she believed that it was possible and that President Carter could use the bully pulpit, could use the power of the office to educate people about why it was important. And she spent a lot of her political capital in the White House trying to convince him to do so. And he didn't. And I think that was one of her great regrets, that she wasn't able to do that.
The unspoken sort of notion of your book is that people like Midge Costanza get forgotten by history. She did so much, and yet she really isn't a part of the history that mainstream Americans know about or would even learn about. Why do you think that is?
Part of it was because she was an individualist, an individual, and so she was often out of step with both the women's movement and the Carter White House. Part of it, I think, is because she was a working class person in a very professional environment. Part of it is also because she was a first woman who didn't effortlessly sail over the hurdles. She was a female first who got beat up by sexism and classism. We somehow want to tell a story that women entered into the ranks of power and then all was well. And this is a story of a woman who entered into the ranks of power at the highest level and all was not well.
Doreen Mattingly is Associate Professor of Women's Studies at San Diego State University and author of A Feminist in the White House, Midge Costanza, The Carter Years, and America's Culture Wars. Doreen, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Take this with you today. When two Stanford graduate students, Jerry and David, created a website in 1994 called Jerry and David's Guide to the World Wide Web, it seemed like a good idea. Millions of users said it was an insanely good idea. And 3 months later, Jerry Yang and David Filo renamed the site Yahoo, a cry that has been echoing ever since. At one point, it was the most popular first stop when people logged into the internet. But now, many billions of users later and $4.8 billion on the table from Verizon, the struggling Yahoo will sell its brand and core business to a phone company. Nobody knows what Verizon means, but internet weenies know that Yahoo stands for yet another hierarchically organized oracle. Yet another hierarchically organized oracle bites the dust. And a couple more former Stanford students go straight to the bank. Big hello to Pittsburgh, where you can hear The Takeaway on 90.5 WESA. We are so happy to be part of your day. Thanks for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.